dusty. Go lie down.
Welcome to Command Control Power, a weekly podcast hosted by three certified members of the Apple Consultants Network, drawing from over 30 years combined experience. We talk shop, interview vendors and colleagues, and share what we've learned while operating our technology consulting practices. This is Joe Saponari of CIMAC, and my two co-hosts are Sam Valencia of the HCS Technology Group and Jerry Zygmunt of MacWorks. We are live at commandcontrolpower.com, the first Tuesday of every month, where new episodes are posted weekly. Thanks for listening.
This episode of Command Control Power is sponsored by Watchman Monitoring. Watchman Monitoring is your gateway to managed services. So I know there's been a lot of discussion, Joe. In the upcoming weeks, we're going to be doing a residential roundtable with some of our listeners that we've invited to join us, and they're going to give us mostly the pro side of working with residential clients. Certainly great to hear you, Sam, and I all the time, but it's really wonderful to hear some of our listeners give their feedback. It's so helpful. I kind of wanted to begin by just saying I might be having to eat some residential crow starting now.
Did you land one of these residential whale clients, Jerry, or what changed your mind?
I'm a single member LLC. I kind of prided myself on running a bit of a boutique setup where I would pick and choose my clients, but times, they are a-changing, as Bob Dylan said years and years ago. Right. And Apple, it's kind of clear in very many ways they're moving farther away from the enterprise realm. You know, in some cases, you could argue the point that they're not. But generally, if we look at the big picture, Apple's moving away from the enterprise space. You know, I don't know if that's reflected in the amount of volume of work that's coming my way, but I always feel like, certainly being a one-man show, you can be dynamic and change your focus from time to time or change your lens when necessary. Have generally felt within the last quarter of this year that maybe I need to focus my lens a little bit more on the residential scene to invite more work. I certainly haven't lost clients through attrition. Most of the clients that I've had and the ones that are doing managed service, they're happily humming along. And so we have that book of business on our radar screen. But at the same time, I'm not seeing enough small to medium-sized business coming in at a regular pace, or at least the pace I'd want it to. So I need to find other ways to generate revenue. So I'm kind of like looking at the residential space, and maybe all those things that I said, all those bad things about it, I need to re-examine.
Yeah, well, it would be good to have you on our residential team here, Jerry, after all this time. You know, you've always had, I think, very reasonable concerns about residential clients, and we've certainly heard some concerns from our colleagues as well. Then again, there's, I think Alan recently mentioned this, Alan Hancock, that it's hard to kind of draw that line sometimes anyway. He mentioned being at a residential client, configuring a VPN to the home office for business use. You know, is that a residential client? I mean, it's at someone's residence, but they work for a company, and so there's some business aspect to it as well. I guess what we're sort of drilling into is like really traditional residential, like home type client, where the task at hand would be helping someone fix their email that's not working, maybe helping them put together a photo slideshow on occasion. We can name any number of tasks. Are those the types of things that we as consultants want to be doing on a day-to-day basis? That's one question. And I guess the other question is, you know, are these the types of clients we can form a healthy relationship with? And I think that's probably the bigger question for some of us, because there are unique challenges to dealing with residential clients, just the sort of patterns that they follow. You know, they're not 9 to 5. You might get the call at 8:30. Somebody's trying to do homework and the internet's down, or they can't print. It doesn't mean you have to answer it. So there's ways of dealing with residential clients that can work for everybody.
I mean, there are a number of challenges. One of the ones that has always frustrated me is the follow-up. Sometimes when you go to a residential client and you perform some work on their computers, all of a sudden you're getting follow-up emails and follow-up phone calls that this isn't working and that's not working. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're pointing the finger and they feel like when you came there to perform whatever work, to, let's say, get their email working, that all of a sudden now you're responsible for all the other things that may not necessarily be working on the computer. And they kind of, it's hard for them to delineate specifically what you've fixed versus what still might be an outstanding issue. And they tend to point the finger and not accusatory, but a lot of times they feel like, well, you should have taken care of that when you were here, or you should have seen that. So that's always very challenging. I think one of the things that really comes into focus is, and we've talked about this before, is how important that signed agreement you might have with your residential client. And we talked a little bit about this with David Sparks, where it may not be this broad form managed service agreement that you have with a client, but on the back of the invoice, at the time, let's say that you're performing service, there should be a place for them to sign. That's one policy that I've sort of kept in place as I've been starting to work more with residential clients, and as I will in the future, is that before I perform any work, I've got an invoice walking in the door that basically gives the hourly rate, and if I'm charging travel, the travel time is on there. Before we start, we just say, this is our agreed hourly rate, and this is what we're going to be charging you per hour. If you could just sign the back before we start, that would be great. Surprisingly, there hasn't been that much pushback on it. Sometimes if you make too much of a big deal about it, they tend to question what you're asking them to do. And one little catchphrase, and I don't know how great it is for me to say this or not, you know, I say, well, you know, we need you to sign the back because it's basically, I'm not going to sue you and you're not going to sue me. And they kind of laugh and they happily sign it. If anything possibly should go wrong, either from the, hopefully not on our side, but their misconception or misunderstanding of what services you provided versus what you didn't do, whether they're accusing you of deleting files. And no, we've talked about that too. At least you've got some layer of protection even before you handle their equipment.
Right. Yeah. I think, I mean, it definitely gives us peace of mind to have that signed agreement, and it's like a backstop for the whole relationship. It's something that I know I need to do as we've grown our client base. Maybe I shouldn't say, but we don't have this in place right now. We, you know, we've been basically working on just a best effort, sort of handshake, and largely just sort of riding on our relationship and reputation with clients. I've often mentioned having that sort of organic network of clients has a lot of benefits in the sort of higher quality level of, you know, leads and referrals we get, but also just in the fact that they sort of know each other, and clients just in being part of that network keep each other in check almost. You know,
right. You're a known entity as you walk in the door. It's not like you're just the hired gun to fix the refrigerator.
But you make a good point, because we do get that question oftentimes where, like you said, you know, they can't necessarily determine, you know, what's related. Like, is it possible that this thing stopped working because of something we did? And because they aren't equipped to determine what's connected and what's not, they just kind of assume everything is connected. And we often get that question that starts with, since you were here, since the last time you were here, implying that, you know, something has happened and it's our fault, like, you know, based on something we did last time, you know, something else stopped working. And sometimes it's true, you know, sometimes it's a setting we changed, and sometimes it's a matter of explaining why. Well, now when I delete photos on my phone, they delete from my computer. And it's like, well, that's the way it's designed. You know, you're using iCloud Photo Library, and it's just a matter of explaining that again. But other times it's like explaining that actually this has nothing to do with the other thing, you know, for their sake, and just to also to establish the ground rules of the conversation. And sometimes it's not even worth having that conversation, because that's just their MO. They just want to place blame early and often. And, you know, that's the way they do business. And we just sort of move on, and it doesn't really matter. You know, we're not going to charge them if it is our fault. You know, we're going to waive the charge. If it's not our fault, we're probably going to charge them. You know, and then let them dispute it if they want. And, you know, we kind of explain it from there if necessary. But, you know, there's ways of sort of navigating those situations as well. I'm curious, you know, as you begin to expand more into residential or being more willing to take on that type of client, you know, obviously I want to hear more about your experience and what some of the pitfalls are and what's working well for you.
Right. And it's not like in the past we had sworn off residential clients completely. We were still performing residential work when it came in. But I think that I need to use that as an opportunity to bring in more work, because as Apple kind of moves its focus from the enterprise space, I need to too. Can't wait till the referrals from businesses become less and less. And all of a sudden, like, I wake up one day and go, oh my God, I got to do residential work. But I think going back to just performing residential work, you've really got to be thick-skinned, and you have to have develop a thick skin and have a certain temperament for it. I know in the pit of my stomach, I feel it when I get that follow-up email that comes in the evening after I had been in a residential client during the day, you know, and you're just settling down, you've had your dinner and you're going to relax with the family. And some email just shows up in your inbox that says, you know, ever since you left, the Wi-Fi is worse. It just eats away at me, you know, and it gets me. So having that signed agreement, they could contest it and how well it holds up in a court of law. Not that it would ever go to small claims or something like that, but it's at least gives you a little bit more of a feeling like you've got some cushion or some layer of protection behind you in people perhaps questioning the work that you've performed for them.
Yeah, it definitely is a good peace of mind. But I do feel the same way you do, Jerry. When you get those emails, even if the client isn't necessarily even trying to, you know, place blame, or the fact that they're mentioning something's wrong, it just, yeah, it's not a good feeling to feel like, oh, you know, they're stuck and I either have to do this now at an off hour when I'd like to be relaxing with the family, or I have to kind of sit with this overnight, feel like I'm leaving them in the lurch somehow. I think it is more unique to residential clients because they do tend to operate at those off hours.
Right. And that's one of the downsides to doing point of sale software for the restaurant business, is that a lot of times when it's showtime for the restaurant, it's when you're finishing up your business day. Right. And a lot of times it moves into the evening hours. Most recently, we did a residential call, and this is just one of the downsides to residential work. And they had two small dogs, and I had a dark pair of pants on, and I had other client calls to make. And it was a kind of a wet day, and the dogs were leaping and jumping, and they're like, "You're not allergic, are you?" And I'm like, no, we love dogs, we love cats, this is great, you know. But at some point you're waiting for the owner to take the cue and say, "Rusty, go lie down." But when they're not, once you sort of like said, "Oh, no, you know, the dogs are fine," and then the dog keeps on like jumping on you and God knows what else doing to your leg, it's always a challenging thing. And finally, on this one particular call I'm thinking of, I had to say, "I need to make some other calls today." So, and she's like, oh, sorry. You know, and then right. "Rusty, go lie down." But it was two, you know, coming at me from two different directions. But that's always a challenge.
It is a challenge. Yeah. You don't often see dogs, you know, jumping on people in an office, although I'm sure it's been known to happen. But yeah, that's another unique situation in a client's home. So
not only do you find animals at residential clients, my most unusual animal for a commercial client was, we support a kosher catering business. They have a pig that is part of the office. If you don't believe me, we're going to put it in show notes. The pig hoofs jumping on your pants makes quite an interesting imprint.
That's pretty funny.
But
I'm sure somebody out there works.
Yeah.
I'm sure some of our colleagues work at a farm or something like that, have farmer clients or whatever, where they've had other animal prints on their stuff. I always wear black too. That's the other problem, is, you know, just wearing black pants all the time. And so I get the white dog hair, and people are always apologetic, but somehow it doesn't stop the dog from jumping and rubbing and everything else. And
yeah, doing the Johnny Cash look has its price to pay. You know, you know, if you're the man in black, you know, sometimes it comes at a cost.
It's true. Well, it'll be good to talk about. We do have a few listeners joining us as guests to discuss this. Remy Kremers, who's giving a talk about this subject at the ACES conference later next month. As we record, I guess it's next month, but that'll be in May, the ACES conference. So if you haven't signed up, go to acesconf.com. Time is running out to see Remy talk about this in person and see a lot of other of our colleagues discuss lots of interesting topics, as we've mentioned in the past. Also joining us will be Adam Rice and Andy Espo. Now, Andy, I met actually Adam and Andy for the first time, I think, last year at ACES. Andy is someone who also specializes in residential clients. And so, you know, there aren't too many of us out there who openly, you know, support residential clients. And so we invited some of them on the show to discuss this very topic. So I think, Jerry, it's a good timing for you, it sounds like. And I'm looking forward to it as well.
I'm eating the crow right now. So I want to garner wisdom from these residential experts, including yourself, Joe. And that's the most difficult thing for me, again, is developing that thick skin. And I know you're very resilient. Previous experiences with residential clients, you've got a lot of tenacity. You're a good man.
Well, thanks. I mostly just, you know, vent to friends and family about these client situations I get myself into sometimes. And, you know, I've been known to vent on the show as well about this sort of thing. So yeah, it's about having a thick skin. It's also about finding those outlets for communicating what those issues are. And I think also just it's about not letting it bother you past a certain point, because people are people, you know, and especially in a residential context, people really are people. And you get to deal with lots of different personality types. Yeah, we'll talk more about it. It'll be fun.
Absolutely. Do you use any kind of a shared clipboard app on your computer where you can call previous paste to the clipboard? In the latest versions of macOS, there's multiple undos, but I'm talking about any kind of a clipboard app.
I actually haven't ever used one. I've you know, helped clients with them, but no.
It's just been invaluable to me, and I use it daily. The product I use is something called Alfred, which does a lot more things. It's also an application launcher, and there's another app out there called LaunchBar, which does this as well, and I believe they have a shared clipboard. If you haven't test drove one of these apps, we encourage you to look at both LaunchBar and Alfred. Alfred is just amazing. It can launch so many different things. You can do quick lookups. It's like Spotlight on steroids. You could do everything from your Alfred app. It brings up a window, and then you just type in wherever you want to go, whether it's a website, a contact card, an email to a client, a previous paste to the clipboard, and it can save back to a month, back to 6 months. It's pretty cool. Hmm. It's got so many bells and whistles that you couldn't possibly master it. It takes a certain amount of time to use the application. With myself, with Alfred, I'm probably using only 5% of its capabilities, but it's just truly amazing.
Well, yeah, that does sound pretty useful. I guess my main hesitation, well, first of all, I just have an aversion to, like, you know, installing new software. There's a pretty high bar, like, for me to install an app that's running all the time. I need to really, really want it, tend to just set a high bar for that. But aside from that, also just the security concern, you know, in that I'm copying a lot of passwords and other sort of proprietary data to the clipboard. And I don't know if I want a third-party app to remember that indefinitely and keep it on a file somewhere that, you know, may or may not be secure, that kind of thing. So no judgment as far as I'm concerned, but that's just the other reason why I sort of hesitate to do that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Although it doesn't go anywhere. It's not copied to any kind of a cloud service, and there's no syncing that's involved there. It's just local to your Mac. So, I mean, I look at it as just like a pasted file. It does respect some of the copying and pasting that 1Password will do. So you can integrate it with 1Password. So it picks up some of your 1Password saved locations. But just like 1Password doesn't copy password to the clipboard, you could specify that in preferences. This will honor that.
Yeah, that makes me feel a little bit better. The other one that I'm a little concerned about the password aspect is Text Expander. We've mentioned it before, but just because it's relevant to this, it will not offer to autocomplete to expand, you know, your snippets when you're typing in as some kind of secure input field. But the other thing it's supposed to do, it has this feature where it can remember and, like, automatically suggest snippets of text. Like, if you're oftentimes saying, you know, cheerio, good friend, or something like that, and close an email, it will offer to create a snippet for that text. Found that there were times where it was offering to create a snippet for a password because I would type it in Apple Remote Desktop. It's a secure input field on the other side, but, you know, as far as Text Expander is concerned, Apple Remote Desktop, you know, typing to certain computers, I guess, was text that it was just watching like any other text. So the first time it suggested one of my passwords to me as a snippet, I turned that feature off immediately. I just can't have that happening, you know, in front of a client or something. So. So anyway, it is something to be concerned about. But then again, it's really good to know that these things are out there because it can be super useful. You know, it's more likely that you're going to forget that you just copied something and clobbered whatever was there that was really important text, like I've done. Yeah, it's nice to be able to get it back with the clipboard manager.
Agreed. You got a lot of work to do, Joe. You got, you know, got to start working on Alfred, and then you got to get your contract together for your residential clients.
Exactly. Got a lot going on.
It's tough when you take vacations. You know, you just...
That's exactly. If you ever want to take a vacation, you got to deal with the fallout and the catching up. So I'm not speaking of anything in particular other than listening to last week's show. We talked to Kevin Ginger about his QNAP fiasco and just recommendation on the QNAP over some other alternatives. And we talked about the Promise Pegasus and one reason why Kevin had been using the Thunder Bay from OWC instead of the Promise Pegasus is that when a drive fails in the Pegasus, it brings the whole unit down. And I think we weren't exactly clear on what we're talking about. I just wanted to make sure to clarify for listeners that we're not saying that there's data loss that occurs necessarily. You know, the Pegasus, of course, does raid 6 or raid 5 if you want to, I guess, skate a little bit by the seat of your pants. What's the phrase I'm looking for? I recommend raid 6, of course, but you can also do raid 5. But if you're using either of those, with when a drive fails, you don't lose data. But the Promise Pegasus can't seem to maintain through that situation. So the drive fails. It seems to need oftentimes a hard reboot to bring it back up to get it to mount. And sometimes it'll actually freeze the whole host as well, like the Mac Mini or the Mac Pro or whatever it's connected to. Pretty unfortunate, pretty annoying, considering the whole point of RAID is to survive a drive failure. And the data survives, but the unit itself just can't seem to maintain through that. So I wanted to clarify that the data is not risk necessarily. It's just the frustration over having to like physically reboot the hardware to get it to keep working.
Agreed. We had mentioned OWC in not very glowing reports from some of their products. And I really want to support this company. And they have a lot of products, which actually are extremely helpful to consultants. You know, they obviously offer upgrades for SSD drives and MacBook Airs and MacBook Pros. At the same time, you know, this lack of reliability in honoring their warranty and their return program is so lacking. Just unfortunate, because I really want to like this company. I just tend to stay away from them as much as possible.
Yeah, I'm with you on that too. And I've been probably one of the bigger proponents of OWC, even through other colleagues, you know, who've a little bit more sort of down on OWC. I've stuck with them longer, I think. But lately, it's just hard to support a company like that when products are just not quite there. I mean, I feel like the reliability is somewhere around 80%. And, you know, I really would like it to be like 99 or 100%. It's not worth it. It's not worth it, especially when it comes down to speccing out a product for a client. Like you mentioned, they do offer these upgrades for MacBook Air, MacBook Pro. Well, I don't think any other companies really do offer those upgrades. They've really helped in certain situations where you just need to, you know, you want a storage upgrade. You don't want to buy a new Mac. And it's something we can make a little bit of money on doing the labor for the client. So it seems like it's a win-win for the client and for us and for OWC, or at least it should be. But then when you have, like Kevin had, 5 or 6 out of 6 failures in the Aura product.
Yeah, that's what he reported.
The ones I've done in the past, we did have several fail. You know, it wasn't like we had done 100 and we had 3 fail. It was something like we had done 6 and had 3 fail. That's not good enough. I have this OWC USB-C dock for my MacBook Pro. It's a really nice product on paper, and it works in practice to a point. And it's, again, like 80% reliable. Every like 2 out of 10 times, every fifth time I plug this thing in, doesn't supply power. And I have to like unplug it and plug it back in, and now it works. There's no difference. You know, it's not like I'm doing something different. It just sometimes doesn't work. So for a client, that's frustrating. I'm going to get that phone call. It is frustrating that the reliability just isn't there.
So recently, the good folks at Seagate sent a couple of hard drives for my Synology NAS. Synology tends to be my NAS of choice, not only for here in the office, but also for my clients in terms of what it can do. You name it, it can do it. But also in terms of reliability, I've had really good performance from my Synology NAS boxes. Seagate is making optimized drives for NAS. They've built a little bit of extra functionality into these drives that work only with Synology. So the drive series is called Iron Wolf, and they make an Iron Wolf drive, and then they make an Iron Wolf Pro drive. One of the differentiating points is that the Iron Wolf drive has a limited warranty of 3 years, and then they have a Pro drive, which goes out to 5 years. But also very, very interestingly is in the Iron Wolf Pro series, they have data recovery, which is built into their product for 2 years. So if you have one of these drives fail on you, you can send it off to Seagate up to 24 months later, and they're going to recover the data for you or assist you in trying to get that data off of the NAS. Hopefully, you'll never be in that position. They make drives up to 10 terabytes. So they sent us 2 10 terabyte drives to evaluate. I get excited when I see something that's built really well. And the enclosures for the 10 terabyte drives are like jewels. It's just amazing the weight of this hard drive enclosure. But it got me really excited. I'm testing them in my Synology NAS, my 5-bay Synology NAS. And I replaced both of my 3 terabyte Seagate drives that I had been using before. They have a testing suite built into it called the Iron Wolf Health Management. And what it will do is it'll monitor things that a regular smart utility can't do. They call it an intelligent analysis of drive health that goes far beyond normal diagnostic tools. So built into these drives is firmware that can look at things like temperature, shock, vibration, and recommends preventative measures. So it even preemptively can make analysis of your drive and warn you in advance if there's imminent failures. So as soon as you install your Iron Wolf drive into your Synology NAS, and it's either the regular Iron Wolf or the Pro line, it's immediately recognized by the Synology. So once it's formatted and made part of the RAID, if you open up Storage Manager, there's now an extra tab in Storage Manager. There's a new test that you can perform, and it's called the Iron Wolf Health Test. And you can run that on a regular schedule, but it's immediately recognized. So they have software, firmware that communicates directly with the Synology NAS, and it's unique to Synology and can really put either your own personal NAS box in a much better position to monitor the health of your drives or for your clients. A pretty cool product that I'm really excited about.
That's pretty cool that they've got it integrated to that level. And it's, you know, really nice that the manufacturer supports this level of reporting, because they would know better than anybody which smart status components are the most important. And so that's pretty impressive.
In their documentation, they're telling us that smart monitoring monitors 20 drive parameters. And they're saying with their Iron Wolf Health Management, it monitors in excess of 200 drive parameters. Wow. You know, smart can just say that whether the drive reports like a pass or a fail. The Iron Wolf Health Management can notify you in advance of possible prevention and intervention actions you can do, reports end impact to the drive, but also communicates, they say, different failure modes through output codes where you could talk to a Seagate specialist and they can tell you exactly what's going on with your NAS and your drive array and how to repair it. So the folks at Seagate were nice enough to give us 2 6-terabyte Iron Wolf drives that we are going to bring with us to ACES, and we are going to make them available. Someone could win 2 6-terabyte drives that you could bring home to your business.
So make sure to stop by our live recording at ACES, at the ACES conference, acesconf.com, and we'll be doing a live recording of the show the first night of the conference. Show up for that, and you can win, thanks to Seagate, one or two of these Iron Wolf 6-terabyte drives.
So we'd like to talk a little bit about our longtime sponsor of Command Control Power, and that is Watchman Monitoring. If you're an Apple consultant and you're looking for a fundamental tool to start your business, this is the one asset that you want to have in hand and have in your tool belt to start your own consultancy. Watchman Monitoring is a fantastic piece of software. It's a lightweight client that you put on your client machines. It can monitor your server software. So you're running a Daylight server or a Cario server. It monitors and checks backup operations. It makes sure your client machines are backing up. So whether you're running CrashPlan, Carbon Copy Cloner, Backblaze, Watchman Monitoring monitors them all. It checks your client disk drives, RAID systems. It looks for slow network performance. It looks for problems with the system performance of a machine. And you get all these immediate notifications by email when any of your client machines are exhibiting problems. It checks for malware. It's absolutely fantastic.
So just to give a little something to the longtime subscribers of Watchman, because I think most of us are, many of us are anyway, and if you're not, you should definitely check them out at watchmanmonitoring.com/command control power. There are some things you should know as a Watchman user. First of all, a new idea had come to me when I was presenting some of my managed services contracts, specifically to a new client. So I've had a couple of cases recently where a client will approach me, a potential new client, and they're interested in working with us, and they're actually looking for something like managed services. It's kind of difficult for me. I don't have a lot of experience writing those contracts and presenting that to a client to figure out how to write the contract. And I realized that like step one is I kind of just need like a litmus test for their entire stable of Macs. It just occurred to me, why not install Watchman Monitoring as step one? Even though this client is not yet on the books, they're not yet, we don't yet have a relationship with them, or maybe we're just doing a little bit of project work, we can install Watchman Monitoring on all of their computers. And that's like a really quick way to do basic discovery of all the machines on their network. You know, you get a nice report of all the machines, serial numbers, specifications, how much RAM is installed, what OS level they're on, and you can just right away see some red flags. And not to mention, you can also immediately give a client an understanding of your benefit, your value,
by saying you have five machines with malware, you have, you know, three machines that probably could use a memory upgrade, and there's like six machines that we won't even support because you're running an OS that's way too old. You know, step one is to get these up to date, add RAM, maybe replace these drives with SSDs, and you can easily recap this whole thing just from right from Watchman Monitoring. So, I mean, you can send a link to your client to the Watchman Monitoring installer, just have the end users install it, and it's going to report back to you automatically. You can review that list with your client and say, here's the number of machines I have. These are the users. Is there anybody we're missing? And then you can just summarize that right from the report that you can export right from your dashboard on Watchman Monitoring.
One of the nice things about Watchman Monitoring, too, is they're always adding features. So it's not like you just simply subscribe to the service and that delivery of content that they give you remains the same. They're always upgrading and improving the product, and you still pay the same price. One of the nice things that you had mentioned before, Joe, is when you go into these machine profiles, if you identify a machine that potentially needs upgrades right from the client device profile, you can click a link which will bring you directly to OWC's page. This is Other World Computing or MaxSales.com. You have all the information you need, the correct RAM that needs to go into this machine, the correct hard drive, any upgrades that you need to do. You can be directed directly from the machine profile through Watchman to Other World Computing.
Yeah, it's such a no-brainer. I mean, you know, we all know kind of in the back of our minds, so I think this machine uses, you know, 1600 megahertz DDR3 memory or whatever, but you don't need to like double check it or look up the serial number or do anything like that. You literally just click View Upgrades button on the computer overview, and you'll see a page with the specific RAM, the SSDs that qualify, even like in a laptop, the batteries that you can replace the original battery with if you need a new one, including, you know, OWC's kits to replace the SSDs. If you don't have as much experience doing this, it comes with the adapter to put the drive in for data transfer. I mean, it just makes it so easy just to get a link to the exact parts that qualify for this machine. So I think they've done a really good job integrating that. And it's just a great way to add more value to your managed services offering. So I highly recommend Watchman Monitoring. And as we said at the ACES conference, Watchman Monitoring is your gateway to managed services.
So we've had some recent feedback from some of our listeners, just wanted to pass it along, from listener Tim Hannon in response to our show talking about ways you can build your sort of referral network of high value clients, I guess I would say. The advice that Mike Michalowicz had given in one of these videos, Mike is the keynote speaker at the ACES conference, his advice was ask the vendors who work for your clients to refer you to other clients. So if you cross paths with other vendors, other professionals who are working with your better clients, the type of client, the type of residence, the type of business that you want to work with, or just personality-wise, a good fit, or whatever the case may be, they have people working for them. They have, you know, other professionals, like so they have somebody maybe who does the TV service, or maybe they have a personal assistant. You can ask those other professionals for referrals to their other clients. You know, do you know anybody else who uses Macs at home? Do you know any other businesses that are doing design work? Maybe other lawyers that you work with? That's a type of leading question. So listener Tim Hannon mentioned that he's had some success with this. Most of his referrals have been from his residential clients and his small business clients, but he says he's also built a network of allied professionals who send him referrals, including the following types. So I thought this was a good list here. Freelance PC consultants. So this is one where, you know, we've had some success too. Some of our counterparts in the PC world, Windows world, just choose not to do Macs. Some of them, on the other hand, do say, oh, we do it all. We do Macs, PCs, whatever. But we have others who focus. Like, we focus on the Mac, they focus on Windows. And so they're happy to pass along their Mac-based clients to us, or maybe their clients switch to Mac, or maybe they have a few Macs in an office, and they pass those people along to us. So freelance PC consultants is a good network to work. Tim mentions bookkeepers and QuickBooks consultants. And that's another one where we've had success as well. We have some professionals who work with clients, helping them to keep their books, and you know, oftentimes dealing with QuickBooks, can ask them for referrals to other similar clients. Sales reps of database systems like Mac Practice. We do help some clients with Mac Practice. If there are other people that are sort of promoting Mac Practice, obviously they're promoting it to Mac users. That'd be a network you might want to get into. Tim mentions also professional organizers. That's one we've had success with as well. People who go in and clean up someone's office at home, help them get their files in order, whether it's, you know, physical files or digital files, maybe helping clients go paperless, things like that. So professional organizers. And lastly, he mentions network and phone wiring people. So people who specialize in just pulling cables, they'll be in a home or a business and they'll be asked, can you help me with getting my printer working? Can you help me with my wireless network? And a lot of those people don't necessarily do that. They'll want someone to refer those questions to, and that can be you. So I think that's an interesting list there from Tim Hannon. And he also mentions he will meet these other service providers, not necessarily through his clients, but also at geek gatherings, as he puts it, in addition to the, on-site when crossing paths with clients. So thanks to Tim for that feedback. Much appreciated.
Great list there, ways to get different referrals. You know, this is really common in the wedding business. Typically, there's a little bit of money that it privately exchanges hands with a referral fee. So you could say, look, if you could send us a referral, we'll give you like 2% of our first job, or sometimes, you might have a real rapport with this particular vendor and, you just feel like you've got some goodwill built up and you could maybe pass referrals on to them. There's different ways to do it. No one is adverse to taking a little bit of money. And if they just need to make a referral or hand them your card and they could put a couple dollars in their pocket, I think that's just a great way to get business. I don't think there's anything underhanded or disreputable about that. Like I said, it's very, very common in the wedding business where the photographer refers the florist and the florist refers the person who supplies the chauffeurs. It's a very common business-to-business exchange of commodities.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It's the kind of thing you want to just please the client ultimately. If the client is looking for help, if you can refer someone good, why not do that? I think the term greasing the wheels is actually pretty appropriate. A person, of course, wants to help and wants to refer you maybe because you've proven yourself and they know that you're going to take care of their client. But it just helps to offer them to, a little bit of a referral fee, keeps you top of mind and encourages them, that much more to pass your name along. So yeah, why not? I think that's a good technique. One of our supporters on Patreon, Daniel Escobar of Proactex, passed along a funny anecdote about a question on a certain certification exam. It was a certification test around how well you know a certain type of fruit that grows on apple trees. One possible answer to this question was a certain keyboard shortcut that we mention weekly on this very podcast. And I'm being very cagey because this company, of course, has everything, is under NDA up and down and sideways. So we can't give you the test question, the certification exam, what the certification was. We can only allude to it. It has something to do with things that grow on apple trees. And we won't even say whether the keyboard shortcut in question was the correct answer or not. The name of our podcast may or may not have been in the answer to one of these test questions. So thanks, Daniel, for sharing that anecdote. Definitely got a laugh out of it. If you're taking any tests out there in our listenership, pay close attention and don't let it trip you up if you see that on a test.
Also, if you're listening, we suggest that you do not press Command Control Power right now.
Right. Apropos of nothing, just a good recommendation in general, Jerry. That's correct.
Especially when you're recording.
That's right. That's right. We actually, that's pretty funny. At the last year at ACES, do you remember the listener who came up and said, I saw you guys were doing a podcast and I wanted to understand where you got your name. So I pressed it on my computer right here in the middle of the conference, figured out pretty quickly what that keyboard shortcut does. So that was pretty funny too.
We had a bizarre little happening with a client most recently where I got a text from a client who we have a really good rapport with, and she from time to time will text us if she's got an issue. She said, I can't find my mail app on my iPhone. It's gone. I said, no, that's impossible. You can't delete that application. It doesn't happen. So she goes, no, it's gone. It's gone. And I said, well, swipe down from the top and do a search. And she texts me back and she goes, no, it's not there. All right, I got to do the QuickTime thing. So I said, give me a moment. You're in front of your computer. All right, get a cable, plug it in, remote it in. I started the QuickTime app using remote it in with TeamViewer. I said, okay, now swipe down from the top, type in mail. And sure enough, the mail app isn't coming. Have you ever seen this?
No, I would have had to do the same thing to confirm.
So I Googled it. What do? You Google it. It said that, I don't know why this happens, but we had to go to the app store on her phone And first she typed in email because she said, oh, I did this. And I, you know, tried to download it again. And she typed in email. I said, no, just type in mail. And the mail app comes up and she downloaded it. And within seconds, all her mail accounts came back. All her mail was there. It was like it just vanished.
That's so interesting. So I have never encountered this, but I as you're talking and telling me that this happened, I remembered that they, at some point, Apple made it possible to remove the included apps to, I guess, to save space, and you could re-download them from the App Store. So I went and held on my mail app, and sure enough, I get the X. Yeah. That would have caught me by surprise too, because I've given clients the same answer. Nope, that's impossible. You can't remove those. Here we go. You can actually remove these. You can't remove the phone app, it looks like, or messages, but you can remove mail, calendar, contacts. I guess the ones that, you know, you might get a third-party replacement to, those are the ones where it looks like you actually can remove them now.
I guess this goes into your I should have known this category.
Yeah, exactly. Good point. Well, you reminded me too, Jerry, about that's a great tip about QuickTime. I mean, we've mentioned it on the show countless times. I've used it. I mentioned using it for a presentation recently, and it worked out really well. But I don't think I had ever used it through a remote connection with a client until last week. I had a client who, it was funny, it was actually about mail as well. She was saying, my mail account's not working on my iPhone. A couple weeks prior to that, they had been hacked and we had to set up a much stronger password in her AOL account. And, you know, she was set up two-factor authentication in AOL. So now she's got app-specific passwords for her iPhone, her mail app on her Mac, and so on. So she's saying, like, mail's not working on my iPhone. We had to basically generate a new password, app-specific password for her iPhone. So we did that. I had her put it in. It accepted it. And I said, okay, now go to mail. You know, go to your mail app and check for mail. And she says, nope, nothing's coming in. It's still not showing any new mail. And I'm like, really? You know, are you getting an error message? And she's describing, no. I said, can you swipe, pull down the list of messages, like pull down from the top so you get the little, you know, do you see the spinning gear? You know, so it's updating. And she's like, no, I know what you're talking about, but I'm not seeing a gear. And this went on for probably about 5 minutes of just struggling and flailing, like, what's going on here? It felt like 30 minutes of flailing. It's only so much you can do verbally. Go here, go there, try this. So we get to a point where I'm just like, I don't know what else to do, you know? And I'm like, you know what? Here, do you have a cable to charge your phone? Do you have that cable handy? Get her plugged in a matter of seconds. And I open up QuickTime. First, it shows the client on screen, which is always fun. You've got to kind of warn them, right? It's going to first show your camera, so just hope you're decent. You know, it's one of those kind of things. It comes up, and she like kind of waves, oh, hi, you know. So then I click, and I switch over to connected iPhone. Sure enough, she's not in the mail app. She's in the settings app still, under mail. Oh, gee, you know, it looks like we're in the wrong screen here. All right, I need you to press the home button at the bottom, and then, all right, now you see that mail icon down there? Now tap on mail. Oh, you're a genius. There it is. It's all back now, and it's like, you know, had never been. It was working the whole time kind of thing, but goodness. She just was a little confused, I think. So it's a good trick. That's really useful.
We recently got a call from a client who was having trouble with their Yahoo Mail. So it was an on-site residential job. Happy to take it. They weren't signing into their mail anymore with their password. They were using something called the Yahoo account key. Have you encountered the new Yahoo account key?
I've heard of it. I've never encountered it before.
Kind of uses sort of an app-specific password hidden from view by just tapping on the icon of the key. The user doesn't have to type in passwords, and it basically is part of the Yahoo ecosystem. And I guess this is their effort to make things more secure. I turned it off, and we just created a very secure password, and all her mail started flowing back and forth. It doesn't appear like it's a bad thing that they've implemented here. It does add a level of protection, but at the same time, if you're looking at it for the first time, it's a little bit convoluted, so it's a little bit challenging on-site at the customer to unravel how it's actually working. In my case, I just backed out of it.
I've been there. Been in similar situations where I've had to bang my head against something for a little while and then just, you know, essentially turn it off because it didn't seem to be functioning properly. I've even had that with Apple's two-factor. You're just not getting the prompt on the devices you want to get the prompt on for the verification code. Right. And, you know, or like the one device that has been authorized is not available because the client is actually out, got their iPhone, and it's just too much trouble to try to keep getting that code from them. And so we've definitely been in that position where, against our better recommendation, we have to turn that off at least temporarily to make that work. But yeah, as if clients didn't have enough problems with passwords already, it's like now you're generating this like crazy long password for them. And I did this on the phone when we were setting up that client I mentioned with two-factor authentication. We would generate a password, they'd write it down, and then I'd go and have them type it in again, and they just couldn't get it. And it just, we kept going in circles. It was like they weren't getting it. I think it was something like they were writing down the account password, but then calling it the app specific password. Like it was just a question of which password was which. If you're not sitting there with them, you can't see what they're doing wrong. And it just gets super confusing with all this stuff. So I want someone to come in and fix this. I thought Touch ID was going to be the thing that was going to just unlock it for everybody. And it's getting there, but it's still obviously not, you know, doesn't fully solve the problem, unfortunately.
I mean, we still get calls from time to time about app-specific passwords where you know that they're saying, you know, well, we're using BusyCal and now it doesn't work. It won't update our calendar events. And sometimes Apple will do a security update and you have to go in and you have to create a new app-specific password for BusyCal. Mm-hmm. Or BusyCal up. If you go to this Yahoo page, getting back to their account key, the pitch for it is let your phone be your password. With Yahoo account key, you'll never need a password again. It's two-factor authentication, but it's veiled. It's just not that discoverable.
Well, Yahoo's old policy was, you know, you don't need a password because we'll just let anybody in. So
yeah, come on in.
Right.
Take a look around. Take a look at my bank accounts. Go ahead.
After three failed password attempts, we'll unlock your account for everyone to see. Oh, man. That's pretty sad.
So thanks again to Watchman Monitoring for sponsoring this week's Command Control Power. And check out Watchman Monitoring at watchmanmonitoring.com/commandcontrolpower.